Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This podcast contains explicit language.
The government might shut down this week, and this is the only podcast that can tell you how, why, and also who to blame.
Also, hear our interview with Congressman Ted Yoho, a conservative House Republican who definitely blames the Democrats.
Republicans say text messages between two FBI agents have totally compromised the special investigation into Trump's campaign. What's more likely is that Republicans compromised the agents' marriages by exposing the affair they were having.
And this week, the question of Trump's mental and physical stability reached its savage climax. Is the president crazy? We're the only podcast that has the answer.
I'm Arthur Delaney.
And I'm Elise Foley.
And this is So That Happened, the HuffPost politics podcast about things that happened in politics. Hello, this is Arthur Delaney. I'm joined in studio by my colleagues Igor Bobic.
Hey, Arthur.
And Elise Foley.
Hey.
Elise Foley is the co-host of this podcast, but she's an expert on immigration policy, and that makes her an expert on why the government might shut down.
That's right.
Is not to say that immigration policy would be the actual reason for it, and that's the big debate that's happening now in Congress over whether and how to keep the government open. Republicans have a bill that would do it for just a month, and the big question is who would get blamed if the bill goes down in flames, which as of Thursday morning looks like it could, right, Elise?
Yeah. So Republicans, it doesn't look like as of Thursday morning have the votes on their to pass it themselves through the House because they've got these Freedom Caucus guys who say that they won't support it. So they either need to come up with something that their guys will support, which potentially would make the Senate, you know, unable to support it, or do something that Democrats might vote for in the House.
I talked to a Freedom Caucus guy named Ted Yoho from Florida, and we will have
him. Great name.
It's one of my favorite members of Congress, and we'll have audio of that interview after this segment. And Ted Yoho, spoiler alert, he said the problem that the Freedom Caucus guys have is that they don't throw extra money at the military in this month-long funding bill they've got. So that's basically it. That's the problem the Freedom Caucus has. Right?
I mean, I mean, it's like this whole this is, you know, how Congress works, I guess. But this whole mess of different issues. So you have people who don't want to vote for something because they want more defense spending. They have people who are worried about the levels of spending in general. You have people who don't want to vote for something because it doesn't include something to help young undocumented immigrants. People who don't want to vote for a short-term bill just on the principle that it's wrong and not a good way to run the government to continue doing these short-term bills.
That's true.
So there's just a lot of ways that this thing could go down, and that means government shutdown.
So Democrats in the House, their leaders are saying, don't vote for this because it doesn't include a DACA deal, something to prevent the deportation of Dreamers, people who were brought to this country illegally when they were children. And that Democrats looks like they'll hold off on the House, and Republicans would need to potentially do this by themselves.
It depends. Nancy Pelosi, obviously the Democratic leader, usually has a pretty tight grip on her members, and they follow her lead. But right now they're being put in a tough spot because Republican leaders have effectively weaponized the children's health insurance program. They've added a provision that would fund that program for 6 years to this bill that would keep the government open as a way to, try to get Democratic votes. So Democrats are now being put in a difficult spot where they've been pushing and pushing to get this program funded, and now they finally have an opportunity to do so. But they also don't want to vote for it because it doesn't include protection for Dreamers.
So the six-year funding for CHIP is actually the longest amount of funding that Congress would have ever provided if they were to do that. So that is a big deal. And they're also saying that because the Pentagon piece includes a pay raise for troops, that if you don't vote for this, you're voting against the troops.
That's right. Anytime ever there's a shutdown, I think the troops are one of the biggest parts in it. And even if there is a shutdown, the military still gets paid. And this is what, you know, President Donald Trump is saying. They won't get paid. They won't get paid. They will get paid. They're considered, critical members of the government.
So what Mark Meadows, the leader of the Freedom Caucus, said on Wednesday is that if it gets through the House, you can't blame Republicans. Because once it's the Senate's problem and they need Democrats just because the number of Republicans in the Senate is low, then it will effectively be Democrats' fault if the government shuts down because of Senate Democrats not supporting this package. Do you think that's reasonable?
Both parties are going to say, like, either party is going to say it's the other's fault if there's a shutdown, right? So in the Senate, there is a different dynamic because Republicans can't pass these types of bills or most bills on their own. They need 60 votes to get past a filibuster, and they only have 51. So they need Democrats to vote with them. I think there's an interesting wrinkle this go around because we now have two Republicans. We have Senators Lindsey Graham and also Mike Rounds, who've said that they would not vote for a short-term bill because they don't want a short-term bill, because they say that's bad. So once you start losing Republicans as well, then it makes it harder to blame just the Democrats. But certainly Republicans will do so and say that, you know, they're holding our troops hostage because of illegal immigrants.
Have Republican leaders said why they're doing another short-term bill? Because this, I believe, would be the fourth one in the past, 4 months. Why aren't they doing a long-term funding bill?
Because there is this issue of DACA, Dreamers, who will stand to lose their protection. And Democrats are finally insisting after caving several times. I believe this is the fourth short-term extension bill since September.
I just said that.
And it's finally coming to a head. And whereas in previous times, in December, you had a whole bunch of Democrats voting to fund the government, now they're fed up. And the atmosphere is – there's so much anger out there that they keep having to do this over and over again that it's finally coming to a head.
I don't understand. Why would Republicans use – you know, because Democrats are mad, why would they use a short-term funding bill instead of doing something long-term? I mean, wouldn't Republicans want to take DACA off the table? Why are they setting themselves up for another government shutdown drama in a month?
Well, I mean, you've got the president saying he does not like anything that's coming out of the Congress right now. There is a deal, a bipartisan deal on DACA, and the president says it's not the way to go.
Oh, my God. The president sent the dumbest tweet on Thursday morning.
Did he? Really?
It said that he did not – Elise, could you bring it up so we have
sure.
it verbatim? It betrayed no understanding of the situation whatsoever because he seemed to complain that CHIP would be authorized for only 30 days.
Yeah. So here it is. CHIP should be part of a long-term solution, not a 30-day or short-term extension. Which is not what House Republicans are proposing, a 30-day CHIP extension.
So it's as if I guess you could say he's complaining that the long-term reauthorization of CHIP is part of a short-term government funding measure, but that, you know, that makes no sense. And John Cornyn actually chimed in with a tweet to say just that, the CHIP reauthorization is long-term. Come on, man. And Mitch McConnell had been complaining, we don't know what the president wants.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'd have to go pull up what was being said on Fox and Friends this morning to find out why he tweeted that. But it's just another example of Republicans are trying to do something that the president will support, but they can't figure out what he's going to support. So Mitch McConnell said on Wednesday that they, on immigration, they want something that the president will sign. That's their priority. And they still aren't sure what that is. So if you have this constantly moving target, how do you come up with a deal that he'll support? I think that's why these other senators came together and are like, you know what, why don't we make a deal and we can send it to him and he can, you know, either say yes or no versus us trying to constantly guess what it is he wants.
Yeah, clearly this is the art of the deal, right? If you read the book that Donald Trump wrote.
I know you read it.
Oh, I read it many times. Have it constantly.
Many times.
Have no real ask, right? Anytime that you say something else. I'm being completely facetious here. This is like the totally opposite way of negotiating.
Okay.
Because his asks keep changing every single day, depending on who he talks to, depending on what he sees on television. There's no – he doesn't really believe in anything. He just says things.
Yeah, and on immigration, people need to remember that this stuff is all super, super complicated. So they said last week, okay, we want these four things. We'll do some sort of relief for Dreamers. We also want to end the diversity visa lottery. We want to end what they call chain migration, which is family-based immigration aspects of it. And also we want more border security and we want some wall. So – but all of those things, there are different ways of going about all of those things. And there are things that Democrats are willing to agree with and things that they aren't. And so just making these like broad statements – isn't even that helpful, even if you do have other people from the White House being a little bit more detailed, because the whole thing can just get derailed by a tweet.
So there are reasons that this is extremely complicated. There are two chambers of Congress with different rules. There are multiple policy provisions which, like you just said, have different ways of being achieved. And there are multiple factions in each chamber that want different things. But one thing is simple, and I think you, Elise, wrote a very clarifying article, and it is the question of whether Democrats will stand up for Dreamers, this constituency of people who, through no fault of their own, were in this country illegally as children, and who, because of action taken by President Trump, will lose a protected status in large numbers come March and potentially be deported and have their families split up and be sent home to dangerous countries where they could die. And Democrats, when they had the last opportunity in December to withhold support from a government funding bill, if it didn't help them, they didn't take that opportunity. And now they have another chance.
Yeah, exactly. And they Democrats promised over and over last year, we will not go home until we – for Christmas, until we fix this. And a lot of them did vote against it. I mean, in the House – most Democrats voted against it. Most Democrats in the Senate voted against it.
In the House, they all no one voted for it until it had already achieved the number, you know, enough Republican support to pass without them, and then they voted for it.
Yeah, but it's the Senate where they have a little bit more power potentially, depending on various dynamics in the House. They sometimes have more power there as well, but in the Senate, they have a lot of power because literally nothing can pass without their votes. And so if they, you know, stand together, they have a lot of power. That's what a lot of people are asking them to do. But whether they agree to do it is the big question. I think one thing that's interesting is the dynamic of people who are now saying, I won't support this type of short-term funding because I don't support this short-term funding on principle. That allows them to not be potentially not be labeled as they shut down the government over Dreamers, but instead they shut down the government over this is not the right way to, you know, fund our military.
Well, yeah,
at least rhetorically, it gives them another excuse, which maybe is helpful on the side for Democrats trying to have leverage.
How are you going to blame Democrats anyway if it was a bipartisan coalition that opposed the measure? But what I don't understand is why did Democrats – they seem to accept the argument, which is propagated basically by the House Freedom Caucus, that if Senate Democrats don't support a government funding measure, it's their fault if the government shuts down. I personally don't think that that is reality, because it is up to the party controlling each chamber what gets voted on.
I think we don't know yet who's going to get blamed.
But anticipating blame is the whole – is like 50% of what's happening.
That's right.
At least right
now. Don't
you
think, though, the media – not to get meta here, but the media plays into that somewhat?
Yes.
Like the question is always, will you, Senate Democrats, shut down the government over and over? And I'm not saying Huffington Post doesn't do this as well. But that's always that the way it's framed is that they would be it would be their fault.
I think the media actually is unintentionally carrying water for the House Freedom Caucus position right now, and it you know they don't really need to, but that's what's happening, and that could shape the public perception of the outcome. But I don't personally think it's necessarily an accurate description of what's going on. Like Republicans control both chambers and control the content of the legislation they'll put on the floor in each chamber.
Yeah, and I mean, if they wanted to vote on something to do with DACA, it really wouldn't be all that hard for them to do it. All this stuff is really complicated, like I said before. But there are a bunch of bills that have existed for a really long time that have gotten a bunch of votes in the past that, you know, they could put up one of those. There's this bipartisan group that currently they have, I believe, 7 Republicans who've said that they would support this deal. And so if you get every single Democrat, that means that you're 56 votes. So pretty close to passing the Senate. You know, it's a different question in the House. But there are options, but instead they're just holding these meetings and taking forever and not coming to any sort of solution. I think that Democrats are frustrated at how long this is taking. Trump ended this program in early September, and a lot of Republicans are acting as if there's absolutely no urgency, even though at the moment we're nearing the end of January. All of this stuff is set to get even worse. It's already had an effect, but get even worse in March. So Democrats are like, no, this you can't take so long. You need to hurry up.
President Obama created this program after comprehensive immigration reform flopped.
And after the DREAM Act flopped, before comprehensive immigration reform flopped.
Well, the point is he created it because of congressional inaction, and that's why it had trouble in courts because it was a question of whether he'd overstepped his executive authority.
I'll do another correction. Okay. I'm being nitpicky. It has not really been challenged in courts. The program that he created after comprehensive immigration reform was challenged in courts and was blocked in courts, but DACA itself was not. There was a threat that Texas would sue over it, and because Texas threatened to sue, Trump said, okay, we'll just end it.
The reason I was trying to do that backstory, which I mangled, was that President Trump, when he ended DACA, said, fix it, Congress.
Right.
So this is their job, and they're not – they appear not to be doing it.
And they say that they want to, and I think there's varying levels to which that's an earnest desire. But all the immigration reform efforts that have failed in the past, it's been because they have tried to add a bazillion things to them that, you know, kill the support from people from one party or the other. That's what certain senators or certain House members on the Republican side especially are trying to do now, I think, is add a bunch of stuff that Democrats are just not going to be able to accept. And so, there's a potential that this all falls apart just like things have in the past, even though a lot of people are insisting that they do care and they want to do something.
All right, Elise Foley, Igor Bobick, thank you.
Thanks.
We'll be right back.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Back. Hello, So That Happened listeners. Some of you may remember that we used to have a Republican congressman named Reed Ribble as a monthly guest. We were sad that he retired, but I would like to introduce you to Ted Yoho, a Florida Republican who is a member of the conservative House Freedom Caucus. I caught up with Ted Yoho on Wednesday in the Speaker's lobby. So, Congressman Ted Yoho, the Freedom Caucus is essentially holding out for its top priority, which is the military piece, higher spending on the military while keeping the rest of the government's funding at its current level.
Well, again, I'm speaking for Ted. That was talked about, but I'm holding out for that. They have taken a stance, but you'd have to get the chairman to give you the stance of the Freedom Caucus.
So everyone's wondering if Democrats will hold out for Dreamers, and there will be a debate over who's to blame if the government does shut down at the end of the week. How do you think that could play out?
Well, I think the Democrats ought to be real careful about that, because they're going to hold out funding our troops, a 2.4% increase, getting rid of the medical device and these other things we've talked about to allow Dreamers to stay in the country. And so they're putting people that are here illegally over our troops. And so I don't think that would be a smart play for them.
Democrats don't control the House or the Senate. They don't decide what bill gets put on the floor. And people know that. You know, they also don't control the White House. Do you feel like Democrats would wind up getting blamed, even though they don't control the government?
Yeah, I think it would go down to that for sure, because, you know, if they hold out and, you know, just make sure that DACA is on there, that's a non-starter. Number one, Paul Ryan's promised us that would never come up. And they're siding with Dreamers over military. You know, are people out there defending this country? And that's just a losing argument. I mean, you go back to the American people. We shut down the government and didn't pay our troops because we wanted legal status for the Dreamers. I don't think that would play very well for them.
So there's a troop pay increase in the bill. But, you know, the broader Pentagon is undergoing an audit that, you know, won't be released until later this year. It seems like you could just say it's defense spending, and that is a category that just doesn't get a lot of scrutiny.
Right, and that's one of the things on the last CR. They're talking about upping spending for the Pentagon, for the DOD. And I said, well, you know, we do that every time. When are we doing the reforms? And so it's undergoing that audit right now, and that's something that needs to be. So that was a trade-off last time to get us to here. But I think what my stance is, and certainly it came out into the Freedom Caucus last night, and again, I'm speaking for me, is we need to go a full year for the military. We've seen what a CR does, the havoc it wreaks, the extra money that it costs the American taxpayers. It's just not a way to run the business. And we're at a crisis management, and we're always responding to a crisis. Crisis management always is a poor way of doing business.
All right, thanks, Congressman Ted Yoho. Don't miss your vote.
Hi, I'm Elise Foley, and I'm here with my colleagues Arthur Delaney.
Hi.
And Ryan Riley.
Hey.
And we are going to talk about these FBI lovers and their texts, and also Trump and the Mueller investigation. So basically, conservative media is having a field day with these texts that were exchanged between these two FBI employees that were, some of them, very anti-Trump.
Yes.
And the idea, based on a report last week, that Congress is looking into whether these people are leakers. And so the idea is that these, you know, texts show that the FBI was trying to undermine the Trump campaign, trying to block him from becoming president or something like that. Do I have that right, Ryan?
You do have it right, yeah.
All right, cool. So what's the latest on this?
Sure. I mean, so essentially, I think it's important to sort of start out remembering the context, because we're in a different world than we are right now, right? I mean, at the time, everyone thought that Hillary Clinton was, like, sure to win the election, you know. And there are a lot of these leaks coming out of the FBI that had to do with stories that were sort of maybe anti-Hillary or, you know, basically weren't good for the Hillary camp. But we know now that there are two simultaneous investigations going on. Obviously, the one that Comey spoke about at a press conference that was really publicly out there involving and that was closed, in fact, in the summer leading up to the
campaign. That's the one that some people say cost Hillary the election.
That's that one, yeah. And then we ended up with Comey putting out this letter, you know, just shortly before the election, basically that saying – that implied it was sort of reopened. It became a whole media storm. It was this major thing. So overall, there are a lot of things coming out of the FBI that were not good for the Clinton camp at that time.
It's kind of changed into James Comey being this hero for the left. But as of before the last election, that was not how Democrats felt about James Comey.
Correct.
Or
I mean,
the FBI.
And that sort of – if you want to believe that, it sort of involves erasing everything we know about James Comey, which is that he's a Republican, that he believes in the Ferguson effect, that – I mean, he was like a mainstream Republican, right? That's who he was. He was never he worked during the George W. Bush administration for the Justice Department. He's not some he's not some liberal hero by any stretch of the imagination. But I mean, so now we know in retrospect that, in fact, the FBI was looking into the Trump campaign's ties with Russia at the time. They didn't publicly acknowledge that at the time. And in stories about it that came out were very much so sort of played by the idea that there wasn't much to be found there, this didn't amount to much.
But reporters knew when Paul Manafort joined the campaign that that person had abundant connections
right.
to Russia
right.
through his lobbying work.
Right. And, you know, what Comey has said subsequently is, you know, the reason he treated these sort of differently was that there had already been the decision to make the Clinton matter public and sort of do that odd press conference that he had, you know, just after July 4th and a few months before the election that a lot of people have criticized and was subsequently used as justification for firing him under the Trump administration, which is sort of a funny justification for them to use. But yeah, I mean, essentially, that's the important context I think that is missing from a lot of these stories. The idea that there were all these leaks that were hurting Trump coming from the FBI is sort of like ludicrous on its face, just because that wasn't how things played out. That if that was true, if there were truly people within the FBI trying to undermine Trump, they did a really piss poor job at it.
Yeah, their leaks didn't go very
well.
They didn't turn into many stories.
Yes, correct. Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of information that they could have provided at the time that would have been damaging to Trump, certainly, that wasn't thrown out there.
Yeah, so you and our other colleague, Nick Bauman, saw a bunch of these text messages that were exchanged between these two FBI staffers and kind of put them into context of, what they actually were related to at the time. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. So what we learned early last month in December was that there were these text messages that a former member of the Mueller team had sent. He was a high-ranking FBI official who was working on the Mueller team, and he had exchanged a bunch of anti-Trump text messages. We come to find out that it turned out that he was having a relationship with this other FBI lawyer, and they were sort of texting back and forth and often texting about news stories or sort of like live – a lot of the texts that I read were sort of like live tweeting – or not live tweeting, rather live texting about ongoing debates or the DNC. So, you know, they said a lot of negative things about politicians. They hated Bernie supporters. You know, they hated Eric Holder. They also thought that, you know, Trump was crazy and were really scared about what was going to happen if he actually got elected into office.
So the fact that these two agents were having an affair is incidental to the fact that they were texting and their marriages to other people are just collateral damage.
Correct. Okay. That's
just checking on that.
That is indeed collateral damage. Yeah. As far as I can tell, we don't know this for sure. We don't know if they were, you know, discovered at some time before that. But this came up within the context of an inspector general investigation that was basically looking into how Comey and other FBI officials and DOJ handled the Clinton matter. And because they basically were using their FBI phones, which people who are familiar with this think that's really odd because they should know that all of their text on their FBI phones or, you know, for discovery purposes being in future cases being stored.
It's the FBI.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right.
You would think
you would
they
think
would
that
know
that. They would know that. Yeah.
I was going to say this is a PSA that people shouldn't do that, but I guess for journalistic transparency purposes,
yeah,
go ahead and text whatever you want on your government phones.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but we don't often get those in response to FOIA requests. Those, you know, I doubt, unless you did a very specific FOIA request, that you would ever get those eventually. But yeah, I mean, also there's this weird dynamic because essentially when they rolled this out last month and they lit these text messages that DOJ has now provided to Capitol Hill, they let report. It was sort of this odd circumstance that Business Insider reported out a little bit more about how they actually let people see these text messages. And essentially, you know, they were not allowed to take photos of them. We're not allowed to copy them. We have to go basically and look and say, okay, to DOJ and like look at this printout and read whatever we want. We can take notes and that sort of thing, but that's all we're allowed to do.
So the context of the campaign is very different from today, where you have Republicans in Congress holding hearings based on these texts and saying that they completely discredit the independent counsel's investigation into President Trump's campaign.
Right. Yeah, it's a convenient talking point because, I mean, again, you know, the broader context here is important to remember that there's nothing wrong with FBI employees privately exchanging their views about politicians via text message.
That's not illegal.
Correct, yeah. I mean, the affair actually might be more of an issue under FBI regulations for them then because that would potentially expose them to blackmail and that sort of thing. That could be more of an issue than the actual just exchanging of text messages. You know, there's nothing barring FBI employees from, you know, texting their friends privately and saying, oh, man, this crazy thing I'm watching on TV about Trump or this, you see this crazy story. That sort of thing would be perfectly above board.
But it allows Congress, right, to say, look, we're taking all of this seriously and we're holding investigations, but we're just holding them on this other thing.
Right.
We're just investigating whether the FBI is secretly a pro-Democrat agency.
Right.
Which, as we kind of talked about, is kind of an absurd idea. But it allows them to say, look, we're doing something. We're taking all this seriously. But undermine this other investigation.
Yeah, it's a great way to undermine the entire probe, right? Yeah, I mean, which is really how this is being used at this point. You know, because again, this was before the team was even formed, so it wasn't as though after they were really digging, you know, they're on the Mueller team that then they were texting all these things about, you know, we're going to get Trump and that sort of thing. It was really, you know, these were text messages. When they were sending these messages, they did not believe that Trump was going to win. They thought that Clinton was sort of a shoo-in. At the time. And so this latest round of stories, one specific story actually from The Hill's John Solomon really sort of fit into this ongoing narrative that was essentially saying that these anti-Trump people were sort of trying to take down Trump. And basically what it implied or sort of laid out is the idea that they were, you know, they were talking about stories and it looked like they were maybe talking with reporters. And there's, you know, certainly texts in there that leave open the idea that Lisa Page at least had talked to reporters, but the story was really poorly done because it didn't include any of the real context for what those actual stories were about. And if you go back and you look at what they were texting about at the time, it's actually a story that reflects poorly on the FBI and on the Clinton camp because it's a Wall Street Journal story in late October, you know, a couple weeks before the election that says that the guy who was overseeing this Clinton email investigation, Andy McCabe, who later became FBI director after Comey was fired, his wife had received money from Terry McAuliffe, who was obviously close with the Clinton family. So that was not a story that reflected well, certainly not a story that reflected well on Clinton, and it definitely wasn't a story that hurt Trump.
So it had seemed as though The Hill advanced the story that these pro-Clinton leaker lovers in the FBI were out to get the Trump campaign. But in fact, if you look at their texts and the stories that they were texting about, they were not pro-Clinton at all.
I think that they would both – I think that both of them probably voted for Clinton. I don't think that's but that's not really what the issue is here. It's whether or not they were taking steps to hurt Trump, which has sort of been the allegation. And, you know, their political beliefs are sort of set aside. And I think that the best way to read these text messages is as though these guys are like really FBI ideologues. That's their chief core principled commitment is like that the FBI is the best. The FBI should be powerful. The FBI should keep its integrity. So the stories that they talked to that I, you know, I'd couch this somewhat. The story that it appears that they spoke with a reporter about, where where Lisa Page, she says she threw someone under the bus, is actually a story about the Clinton Foundation, which she abbreviates as CF. And essentially, she's saying she told a reporter when she threw someone under the bus was that, listen, there was this guy over at DOJ, a political appointee of the Obama administration, who was trying to quash the Clinton Foundation probe. And was perhaps unethically sort of, stepping outside his bounds and trying to, tell the FBI what to do. And the entire, principle of the FBI is they're these independent guys. They, charge in and do what they want, and that, they're supposed to have – they're not supposed to be able to be sort of quashed by these political operatives within DOJ. And in fact, she has text messages in there when the one agent when the agent she was having an affair with says essentially, hey, what, have you thought about maybe joining DOJ, theoretically in a Clinton administration? And she's like, no. Like, she does not want to do that. She doesn't want to deal with the politics.
Is there a single government agency that is more mythologized on a daily basis than the FBI? Like, there's how many TV shows and movies where they're just heroes?
Yeah. But, I mean, that's a big part of – like, I don't think that's removed from – necessarily all that removed from reality, because that's – I mean, if you look at so many of the actions of the FBI, it's about a desire at least. Now you could, to uphold their individual – their integrity. That was, like, really how you – you read the driving force of the Clinton announcement that Comey made, is that, he's worried basically that – what's going to happen is Clinton's going to get elected, and then I'm going to be facing all these questions on Capitol Hill about how I handled this from Republicans. And that's why I'm going to make these moves now, because, now it probably impacted the election and probably didn't go the way that he necessarily thought it would. But that's what you can sort of read his moves as, is that, I'm trying to uphold the integrity of the FBI. That's my most important principle. So I want to be able to make moves that I'm going to be able to defend before, when Republicans under the Clinton administration focus on this for probably the next, 4 to 8 years.
So this was such a big thing on conservative media. Did anybody kind of pick up what you picked up about the context, or was this just totally ignored?
No. I mean, everyone – it was pretty much adopted wholesale, because it wouldn't fit – the idea that they were talking to reporters for stories that reflected poorly on Clinton wouldn't fit into the narrative. It was – he had to sort of, shoehorn it into this ready-made narrative that would be adopted by Hannity and earn him a guest spot there and be picked up in the conservative media and aggregated all over the place that, this was – these anti-Trump texters were leaking. Like, right, you could – that's the story that he put forward. Just leaving out that whole thing, it was probably about these stories that were kind of anti-Clinton and reflected poorly, and reflected poorly upon Clinton.
All right. Well, thank you, Ryan Riley. This was really interesting to hear more about. And thanks, Arthur.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Hello, So That Happened listeners. This is Arthur Delaney, and I would like to request that you please give us a rating of 4 or 5 stars in iTunes. Plus, please force someone you know to listen to the podcast as well. We're classified as an essential government service and will not be affected by a government shutdown.
Hi, I'm Elise Foley, and I'm here with my colleagues Nick Wing.
Hey.
And Arthur Delaney.
Hey.
So last week, right after we finished taping, we had a big news event, which is that the president, reportedly, according to Senator Dick Durbin, and contradicted by some people in the room, not by others, said that various countries in Africa were shithole countries. Pardon my language, and that we should send Haitians back to their country. We don't want them. And various other racist stuff, which was in some ways surprising and in some ways not. But it's kind of restarted this whole question over, is Trump crazy? Is he super racist? And how can Republicans best defend themselves while they defend their kind of crazy and racist president?
I think it's the culmination of question we've been asking for the past year, which is, what is Donald Trump's deal? as president? What does he think he's doing? Is he capable of doing this job? Is he fit for office? And the fallout, the shithole fallout, continued all week. It's been a major deal in our politics, and it feeds right into the question of whether the government will partially shut down at the end of this week. And it goes to the question of whether he's sane. And we actually had his doctor come out this week, and I think the doctor answered the question pretty credibly. The guy was also Obama's doctor.
I just want to sort of preface this whole thing with, is he sane and is he crazy, I feel like, are two different questions. I mean, we look at people in this country, I mean, from our liberal bastions on the coast, you probably don't run into these people that often. The defense of Donald Trump for the shithole comment from some Fox News commentators, for example, was sort of disgusting in its nonchalance, right? It was like, he's just the racist guy at the bar saying what people in middle America think. I don't think those people are insane.
Right.
But I think a lot of people would suggest that they might be a little bit crazed.
It's kind of there are various arguments from people about why he might be unfit for office. There's the idea that he is mentally not sound. I mean, he's a 71-year-old, tends to, as reported in that Michael Wolff book, whether, you know, we believe all the claims in there or not, but that he repeats himself. He obviously says some things that are nutty sometimes. So there's this idea that maybe he's not mentally fit. There's an idea that he is a racist who's not fit for office on, you know, those principled grounds. And then also the idea that he's too corrupt to be fit for office. Sure. So there's all sorts of different arguments, right?
I think the shithole story represents everything about Donald Trump swirled together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is partly because it came on the heels of the Michael Wolff book with all the people saying he's crazy, we're going to need to break the glass and hit the 25th Amendment button. And then it came on the heels of him staging a televised negotiation, after which many pundits said, wow, the president really held it together during that, even though
lowest bar.
Right. The substance of what he said there was gibberish.
Agreeing with whoever spoke last, seemed like.
Wasn't the biggest takeaway that he sort of just stated the Democratic position on this whole thing, too? He just, like, undercut.
Yes. But the point is, he had this, like, a few days later, had this raging meeting where he allegedly said shithole in reference to people from countries in Africa. And in the context of the United States with its history of oppression against African Americans, it's a clearly racist statement. It sort of restated things that Donald Trump has done all his life and said all his life. And the way Republicans responded was incredible, with Lindsey Graham essentially confirming that the president said it. He's a Republican senator from South Carolina. But then these other guys who were there saying no.
Well,
no.
At first they said, and this is Senators Tom Cotton and David Perdue, who I think it's worth noting are on the team on immigration. This was an immigration-related meeting of wanting to cut legal immigration pathways, and that's their big agenda there. So the reason, the context in which this came up was Trump voicing support for the policies that they support. And so it's also about the policies, right, not just the language. But both of them first said that they didn't recall hearing it, then later were a little bit more forceful and said that, you know, Trump didn't say it, have basically called Dick Durbin, the senator who was the only Democrat in the room who said that Trump did say this, Tom Cotton basically said that Durbin was a liar. So it's kind of, you know, their word against his word. But there's also been all these other, Nick, you compiled a bunch of them, these other defenses that people have had of this comment from, you know, it's like he didn't say it, or he said something different, or what he said was fine.
I think, I mean, one of the more disturbing things, there are so many disturbing things about this, but the quickness to reframe this as the shithole comment or the shithouse comment or whatever it was being actually a statement of his belief in a policy of merit-based immigration, I think is absurd. Because, I mean, that is a completely different debate. basing your immigration policy on which countries you think are shitholes and which countries you think are not shitholes is not merit-based immigration, right? I mean, to my best knowledge, limiting immigration from places that you think are dirty or disease-infested or poor, what does it have to do with merit-based immigration? How is that a statement of policy? Like, so I, they tried to reframe it in a way that just was not what was happening. He's basing his immigration policy on his own racist stereotypes of certain nations, and to me, that's not merit-based. And you know, I don't see how you can frame it that way.
Yeah. So the reason that African countries were being discussed is that this diversity visa lottery, which Trump wants to get rid of, and has just a totally zany and baseless idea of what it is. He says that countries just pick their worst guys and we pick them out of a hat, basically. It's not true. the big concern about getting rid of it is the way that a lot of people, immigrants from Africa, get to the U.S. because it's for people to immigrate from countries that don't have a lot of pathways. So there's this concern about shutting that down for that reason. You know, in that context, reportedly, I wasn't in the room. That's when he said, well, why do we want people from these countries anyway? So sure, like the idea of a merit-based system is country blind in theory. But at the same time, there are people who really want to protect the, you know, diversity of the immigrants that we do get. And that's the reason for this lottery. So I think that in a lot of ways, that's what Trump said causes those people to double down and say, look, this is just a racist thing to want to get rid of this. Right. This is not a policy thing. This is just because the president is racist.
So he's sort of revealing the deeper seated racism behind a policy that they've managed to pretend is not racist, but actually will have racist impacts if it were to be put in effect.
Can you explain the shithole shithouse story?
Well, it's hard to explain because it doesn't really make any sense. But at first it was – the word he used was shithole, then it was shithouse. It was unclear why that mattered because Trump's position all along has just been denied that he said any of these horrible things. And then it turned out that actually shithole was worse than shithouse because shithole is just a mean thing to say. But shithouse was apparently in reference to like real estate, in that people who have a shithouse have outhouses. Therefore, they don't have plumbing in their places. So it's this very nuanced reference to the level of development in these places, which is complete bullshit. I mean, it's not true.
I thought the reason that the distinction was being made was that Cotton and Purdue had told the White House, we didn't hear the word shithole. We heard shithouse.
Right. It also gave
so
them
we're
going
to go out and deny that he said shithole because we heard this extremely similar word.
Right. Initially, it was just to give cover. And then actually they tried to pretend that there are different connotations to each of those phrases, which I think is equally absurd as just pretending that it never happened.
Yeah, and I think it's also all of this debate kind of one thing we haven't mentioned, I don't think, is that Trump also reportedly said that why can't we get more people from Norway?
Right.
Which also doesn't really back up the idea that the point is to have people come based on merit. Senator Leahy said something this week in a congressional hearing with the DHS secretary. He said that I don't think being from Norway is a skill, which is true. So if you have the president kind of revealing that what he wants to base his immigration policies on is getting more people from Norway versus more people from Africa or Haiti, I think anybody who's reasonable can kind of look at it and say, what are the differences there? And obviously, you know, there are some differences in terms of how developed those countries are. But you have to remember the reason that people have immigrated to the U.S. for the entire history of the U.S., right, is to leave various things in the country that they were in before. So
the president did not – throughout this – the fact that we're talking about it, it's the president not grasping the policy. And the question of his cognitive abilities was huge this week when the White House sent out the doctor who did a physical and a mental exam on him.
Little bit of a mental exam, right?
Well, Nick, you can
– not a psychiatric one is my
– not psychiatric.
The doctor who's completely legitimate and who was also Barack Obama's doctor completely vouched for both Trump's physical and mental health And part of the mental part was he gave him an exam.
Yeah, there's been this undercurrent of questions about potential early onset, you know, Alzheimer's, sundowning, various things, questioning whether he really – his mind is starting to fade. And so he gave him what's called the Montreal Cognitive Assessment. I have a copy of it here. And, you know, it's a pretty basic test. It's the sort of thing that if you gave to probably like an 11-year-old, they'd be able to figure out. It's not testing any sort of real acuity.
We've got the paper here. It's got some pictures
so,
on it.
So here's a fun one. This – I can't, you know, convey this through audio because it's actual visual identification. But there are pictures of three animals. I'm going to give it away here. One of them's a lion. One of them's a rhinoceros. And one of them's a camel.
Nick, it's okay for you to describe the picture. We're not administering the test to our audience.
So those three animals, I think, are they're pretty identifiable animals. And if you can name all three of them, you get 3 points.
So this looks
That's
like it's
three
for
points alone.
What, I think what you're trying to say is this looks like it's for little kids.
It's for little kids. Donald Trump was very excited by the fact that he got all of them correct. And not only was he excited by that fact, he actually – and this is, you know, maybe more evidence of Donald Trump being absurdly just narcissistic. But in an interview with Reuters yesterday, he suggested that his perfect score on this test was an example that maybe his predecessors had left him the North Korea mess because they wanted someone with the mental fitness and acuity to be able to handle such a difficult problem. And Donald Trump is that guy because he got 30 out of 30 on a test for 11-year-olds.
Well, you know, I think that
was a joke.
Yeah. I don't know.
I don't think it's a joke that he thinks he's smarter than Obama, but I think he was joking.
He does think that. I think
in defense of Trump.
I do think that people should set aside the fantasy that he is going to lose his marbles and – just keel over or be removed by Mike Pence.
Yes.
I think he's not – it's not that he's senile. It's that he's just very willfully uninterested in learning anything.
But he's also, you know, as a shithole comment, I think, revealed, he's like an old, racist, rich, white man who watches Fox News all day. I mean,
right.
Know, which makes him unfit for office, I would say.
But that's not the argument of the 25th Amendment people.
Sure.
It's that argument is that he's completely off his rocker.
Right.
And I feel like even though this is a little silly, that shouldn't be what we're talking about. We're talking about a different sort of competence.
I agree. But if you were to add a little bit of instability on top of the basic core personality traits of Donald Trump, it would be – and I think people are very scared that – add a little bit of actual insanity or Alzheimer's on top of those, and we're in for a lot of trouble.
Yeah,
but I agree.
He's impulsive and willfully ignorant.
Yeah, it's one of those things that's good to look into. I think that at the White House this week when they brought out the doctor and had him talk for something
like an hour.
One thing I was frustrated by is that the questions kind of over and over, not to knock my fellow journalists, were like, so is the president crazy? Like, just phrased in different ways, which I'm not saying isn't worth asking. And I think it's great when officials answer questions. But then Sarah Sanders, the press secretary, came out and was like, well, we've already kept you in here for an hour, so we're not going to do very many questions. So also it's like, to what degree is this all a distraction from other stuff? And so, yeah, I mean, I think that there are a lot of questions about the president. Sounds like we've a little bit resolved from one doctor, one of them.
Yes, I totally, that's what I'm trying to say. Like it's time to refocus, we'll have the government shut down potentially in large part because he just doesn't want to govern in the way a normal person would, but it's very willful. And it's not because he's insane.
Yeah, he's erratic, clearly. That doesn't necessarily mean he secretly has Alzheimer's.
Clean bill of health for Donald Trump.
All right. Well, thank you, guys. Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Arthur.
Thanks.
Welcome. So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Zach Young. Our executive producer is Nick Offenberg. I'm Arthur Delaney, and this week we were joined by HuffPost reporters Elise Foley, Igor Bobic, Nick Wing, and Ryan Riley. So That Happened is available on Apple Podcasts. Check out the whole family of HuffPost podcasts in the iTunes store, and while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffpost.com. And thank you to everybody who emailed in response to last week's request that you tell me a little about yourselves. Some of you are doing the dishes, some of you are studying for PhDs, some of you are driving to the dog park with your mom. As far as I can tell, you're all geniuses. Thank you so much for listening and for writing it.
Summer's just around the corner, so give your body the care it deserves with Osea's best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil. Created by infusing Andaria seaweed in barrels of botanical oils, it leaves skin silky soft and glowing. Plus, it's clinically proven to improve elasticity and deeply moisturize without feeling greasy. It's safe, clean, vegan skincare. Get 10% off your first order at OseaMalibu.com with code GLOW, plus free shipping on orders over $60.